how the nation's regions may define our politics. Journalist Colin Woodard is well known for his 2011 book, American Nations. In it, he outlines 11 different distinct areas or nations within the United States, defining those areas by cultural heritage. Recently, Woodard returned to this idea in an opinion piece in the New York Times. He looked at how these regions voted in the last election and argued that the most significant abiding divide in our country is not the urban-rural divide, but rather the regional divide. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, Woodard returns to Maine Calling to discuss this essay and the nation's political divide. As always, we invite you to share your thoughts on what's happening in America. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There's a lot of discussion these days over the great divide between Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals. What accounts for this divide? Many argue it can be traced to differences between rural and urban voters, but my guest today says the root of our current hyper-partisan era go deeper. Colin Woodard is an award-winning author and journalist, and in a recent New York Times piece, he argued that the, quote, most significant and abiding divide in American politics isn't between the city and countryside, but rather among regional cultures. Colin joins me this hour to explain this thesis and answer your questions, and we have posted a link to his article on our website and on our Facebook page. As always, we want to hear from you. How would you explain our nation's current political divide? What thoughts do you have on how to overcome it? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back, Colin Woodard.
Well, thanks for having me.
So your New York Times opinion piece has sparked a conversation, and I want to talk about that piece. But first, I want to go back to 2011 when you wrote your book, American Nations. It strikes me this is long before Donald Trump was even spoken of as a potential candidate. But there was already a lot of discussion about the growing divisions in America and American politics. So if you can think back 9 years, tell us what made you start thinking about this question differently.
Well, my story and how I ended up writing the book go back even further than that, because in university, I was a Soviet East European Balkan history major and was focused on that and spent my junior year abroad in 1989 in Budapest when communism collapsed and stayed on and began my journalism career and spent most of my 20s and most of the 1990s in that region where the deep divides that really matter between empires and culture and history often don't match the lines on the map. And there, for better or worse, everybody knows it. And the knowledge of history and seeing how that unfolded all the way down to, you know, ethnic conflicts and warfare, but also all kinds of subtle and not so subtle cultural differences that divided nation states like Romania or Poland or Yugoslavia were very clear. And it was through that lens when I returned to the U.S. in the late 1990s and started living in many very disparate parts of the country that I started realizing that the same divides were at work in our continent. And the shocking thing was that in many ways they were more profound than the differences between the various Balkan and East European states in fundamental things like, you know, how do you define freedom? You know, what is the correct role of government? What's the relationship between church and state and so on? There's, you know, broad consensus within a lot of European states and even between them that you didn't see there. And again, the lines, the state lines, and sometimes even the international lines clearly weren't the fissures that were at work in many, many states and different parts of the country. So that's actually where I came to it, long before thinking about electoral politics or Donald Trump or even the blue-red map.
So where did you live?
Well, you know, I grew up in Maine. I'm from Waterville and such, but then I went to university in Boston and then was out in Eastern Europe and all that, and then came back and lived in the Washington, D.C. area, in southernmost Texas on the Mexico border, and in Chicago area, mm-hmm. where I actually lived and was, you know, resident in those places.
Right. And we see, you name some others, the definition of freedom and the proper role of church and state, but I'm going to add to that list and tell me if you agree, attitude toward guns.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's, I mean, the, you know, we can unpack this a bit, but one of the central divides in our country and maybe the central debate in the whole American experience is about how you define freedom. And there's two major ways to do it. One is that, you know, that improving and furthering freedom in a free society is about increasing individual autonomy and the freedom of individuals. And therefore, if there were less government and less regulation, less taxes, axiomatically, people would have to be more free, right? There's a zero-sum game there. Then there's a whole other tradition that says, you know, that liberal democracies and that a free society only exists through the careful nurturing and creation of the institutions that make the possibility of individuals exercising their own autonomy possible, and that you have to invest in that and create a republican citizenry, and that requires individuals to make compromises for the common good. So it's a, you know, individual liberty, common good. I mean, the answer is you need to balance the two, but something like gun control and all sorts of issues really boil down to that question at its essence. You know, what is freedom about? Because, you know, gun control is about limiting your individual liberty for the good of the common good, allegedly, and not wanting to have gun controls about maximizing the individual's liberty against a, you know, as perhaps as a tool against an oppressive tyrant. So, yes, that's a classic one, but many, many other of the great debates in our society have to do with that. And hey, look, the regional culture's traditions going back centuries often place each regional culture with a very different sort of dominant received position on that question.
So for those of in our audience who didn't hear the program the last time you were on, and for those who haven't read your book or heard you speak, you have 11 nations, you call them, within the U.S. You don't have to give us all 11, but give me a couple examples of what you've named them, what defines them, and how we can understand them.
Yeah, so all of these tie back to the idea that the that the different colonies that formed on the eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States were settled by completely different peoples. I mean, ethnographically, religiously, they had different political intents. They were founded at different time periods, even within the English ones, but you also had Dutch and French and Spanish ones, and that they all had an impact, and that each of these, not knowing that they were going to end up in a continent-spanning federation centuries hence, was developing as a separate sort of country and nation. They were competitors. They were sometimes at war with one another. You know, they picked opposite sides in conflicts like the English Civil War of the 1640s, or even once the U.S. was created. In the American Revolution, they were on different sides on a regional basis. In the War of 1812, in the Civil War. So these, and the second factor is that all the way through to the 1840s, 1850s, they settled. They spread out, settling westward or northward, depending on where they were, in mutually exclusive settlement bands with very little overlap. So there's sort of a, out of New England, there's a stream that works its way across a northern tier of the country. And out of, say, Charleston in the Deep South, there's another tier working its way down the Gulf Coast and so on. And for a long period of time, it was those extended cultures that ended up setting down the institutions and cultural assumptions and ideas of who we are and all the things that make up what anthropologists think of a culture that laid those things down and the rest of us discovered and arrived at them. So two, very briefly, that would illustrate this. One would be the greater New England space, Yankeedom, you know, started with the Puritans arriving, you know, at Massachusetts Bay, right? They were radical Calvinists who believed themselves to be in an Old Testament-style covenant with God to make a more perfect society on earth right here and now, a utopian project, you know, a city on the hill. And they would do it, you know, through shared institutions, through their meeting houses and town governments, and that the individual had to stand down their interest if it came into conflict with that of the community. And very much so. It was about empowerment and future and eventually freedom of the community, not the individual, being the key emphasis. Take a counterpoint to that is the great, what I call the greater Appalachian space. And this started in south central Pennsylvania and was settled in the, you know, the starting in 1718, 1720, 1730s. And this was settled by an entirely different group of people from the British Isles, from Scots-Irish, Lowland Scots, and people from the English Marches, the war-torn borderlands of the British Isles.
People very distrustful of authority.
Distrustful of authority and living in in war-torn conditions where you couldn't count on institutions or, you know, the police or government or the armies, that all of those would be forces trying to kill you and your family, that you had to defend yourself and your kith and kin personally. And it was a warrior society with great emphasis on individual liberty and protecting it. And it was that stream of people who came into South Central Pennsylvania, and that culture spread down the Appalachian Mountains into the backcountry of states like Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, and on into the Ozarks and even the Texas Hill Country. And another branch came down into Kentucky and rafting down the Ohio River to settle the lower tiers of Ohio and Indiana, downstate Illinois, large parts of Missouri. And this is a society that very much took that freedom as about maximizing the autonomy of individuals, and in fact that organized, frugal, and responsible government, which was the goal of the Yankee experience, was in fact tyranny. And you can imagine how these two groups would have a very hard time ending up in the same federation with one another.
Sure. Fast forward 200 and 300 years, and we have politics today, and these groups have, you argue, sort of divided out into red and blue states and a few purple states.
Yes. Well, the purple states, and because the settlement patterns, and this is all about early settlement patterns, didn't match state and colonial boundaries, it means that in some states, there are enormous and shocking fissures, political and otherwise, that trace back to the differences in these settlement patterns. Places like Ohio, where the northern bit along Lake Erie, where Cleveland and stuff is the Western Reserve of Ohio, because that was the Western Reserve of Connecticut. Connecticut had a territorial claim, and it was settled largely by Connecticuters, bringing their institutions and assumptions with them, whereas the southernmost parts of Ohio were settled mostly by people coming from Virginia and what's now West Virginia and Kentucky, and was very much part of the Appalachian stream. And those areas have never seen eye to eye in Ohio. Try to talk about an Ohioan identity or an Ohioan political identity is a very tricky thing to do. You can say the same about Texas, where Texans know that Austin is the capital of the state, but that Houston and San Antonio and Dallas are the hubs of three very different Texases. The arguments about California's, California just had a referendum they were considering to divide into four states. And, Marylanders talk about where the divides between the different Marylands lie. I mean, Maine happens to be a place that's relatively, part of a single dominant, top scale cultural tradition. But many states are almost defined by these divisions. So, yeah, you end up with red states and blue states and very purple states because of the mix and balance between these regions.
So our president, President Trump, is a product of the area, the small region, the small nation among nations that you call New Netherland. So tell me what New Netherland is, and talk about how his appeal maybe is different than what we'd seen in the recent past.
Right. Well, New Netherland is, the area right around New York City, including parts of Long Island and southern, like Westchester County and its surroundings, northern New Jersey, was all settled by the Dutch initially. It was the Dutch colony of New Netherland. New York City was originally New Amsterdam, and it had a very different set of values from the New England zone and certainly from almost anywhere else. It was a global commercial city-state trading culture, just like Amsterdam at the time was.
Hurly-burly, materialistic.
Yeah, but also enormous emphasis put on the freedom of conscience and inquiry, multi-ethnic and multi-religious, with a dominant culture not being expected or desired. So this leads you to the fact that individuals, we're talking about dominant cultures in every single county and town on the map. You have the full spectrum of political opinion from, radical communists through to, anarchists or extreme libertarians. The question is the dominant environment around you, at your back, or are you frustrated by it? And Donald Trump's an interesting case because, the hurly-burly of New York certainly shaped Donald Trump's life and business trajectory. In terms of his political platform and approach, it's contrary to many core values of New Netherland, which is why Donald Trump did terribly and was rejected by the voters of his home region by large margins. So you can very much have an individual emerge, from a culture that doesn't exemplify all the aspects of it.
So why did he, looking at the way you're analyzing our country, appeal to those voters in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania?
Right. Well, he didn't appeal to all voters in Ohio and Pennsylvania. The critical elements of it, the reason that Ohio and Pennsylvania and some other states are swing states is precisely because they're riven by these, they're divided by these huge tectonic plates, these differences in dominant cultures. And in both those cases, there's a strong greater Appalachian section, which these days has voted very consistently and strongly Republican. You know, again, that individual freedom ethos lining up with the Republican Party more tightly. But that's up against in Ohio, that Western Reserve area, which strongly votes for Democratic candidates. And in Pennsylvania, there's a Yankee section and a large Midland one, which is a little bit in between. So the trick, if you're a Democratic candidate, you have to do very well in the Midland sections and the Yankee sections of Ohio and Pennsylvania, which are more communitarian, more on the success of the community is what matters ultimately more than the individual. If you do badly in those areas, you don't have big margins, you're in trouble because you know that Greater Appalachia is going to go very strongly for the Republican candidate. So Trump's success was that he actually, in addition to, you know, appealing to the Greater Appalachian sections of those states, he also made key inroads in Yankeedom in the Midlands, especially in rural areas, where he made, these are areas that had, especially in Yankeedom, rural areas had gone for Barack Obama by significant margins in past elections, and he flipped all sorts of counties. And we can unpack a little why that is, why he succeeded in making marginal gains in those places where other Republicans hadn't in the past.
In your article, you mentioned he talked about things like infrastructure, which might matter to people in those counties.
So Donald Trump alone among the 17 candidates for the Republican nomination in 2016 was not talking that traditional Republican sort of laissez-faire, less taxes, less regulation, less government will bring more freedom. He wasn't saying any of those things. All the other 16 were, and he totally crushed all of them in the Republican primaries. And then he went on to the general election and was saying the same things. And the key differences were that he was talking about rebuilding the nation's infrastructure. He was going to replace the Affordable Care Act with something with better coverage that would cost less. There was a promise that somehow the government was going to intervene and use its powers to rescue and revitalize manufacturing in the country. He was going to deviate from the past orthodoxy of his party on trade and on immigration issues. So yeah, it was the most communitarian platform, most communitarian campaign pitch of any Republican nominee, at least since Richard Nixon. And remember, these are communitarian regions I'm talking about that shifted. You know, most of the map, Trump did about the same as Mitt Romney, did in 2012, or that John McCain did in 2008. But the big swings were in these rural Yankee counties, and shifting a lot the rural Midlands as well. And those are communitarian regions that he was able to make those arguments to, and to great success, because you overlay the Electoral College, and that managed to allow him to eke out victories in a number of states, and then a Electoral College win, even when he didn't have a majority of the popular vote.
We're speaking with journalist and author Colin Woodard. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com. And Tandem Coffee, celebrating conversation, coffee, cheddar biscuits, and no Wi-Fi. In Portland and at TandemCoffee.com.
Abortion rights advocates want senators to block Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination.
I am the last year of the baby boomers, and people in my age did this already.
His supporters are reaching out too.
And we believe he is the next great justice, and we're so excited about this.
The Kavanaugh nomination fight this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public members make public radio possible here in Maine, and we appreciate gifts of support at all levels. The Beacon Society was established to thank and recognize those members whose annual gifts reach $1,200 or more, or $100 a month. If you would like more information about joining the Beacon Society, we thank you for your consideration. Please call Maine Public at 800-884-1717 and speak to Scott Marshallden. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, the roots of our nation's political divide. Joining me, Colin Woodard. He's state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. He is also the author of a number of books, including American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America, and most recently, American Character, a history of the epic struggle between individual liberty and the common good. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Colin, before we get to the calls, I want to sort of go back to the premises of your opinion piece in the New York Times. It came just a few days after the New York Times had published this really fascinating interactive map that was a county by county analysis of voters in the last presidential election, the kind of thing you could get lost in, especially if you know your geography a little bit. And just glancing that map, boy, it appears to show an urban-rural divide, especially when you see a little island of blue in an otherwise red state. But you push back at this, even though by glancing at that map, it does seem pretty obvious.
Yeah, that's precinct level even. And, you know, at a glance, it does seem obvious. I haven't sat down and parsed that map, but also you get an illusion sometimes where, let's say you had a clump of rural counties somewhere that were all voting Democrat. You would read that if you just glanced at a map as a city, right? It can be a little bit tricky, but no doubt density matters and is a factor in determining how people vote. My argument is that, you know, it's been cast that urban versus rural is the ultimate in defining divide in American politics these days. And that hasn't been true. And, you know, that wasn't true in 2008 or 2012. It was slightly more true in 2016 because of what I just described. But the reason that you had a shift in rural voters in certain parts, in certain regions of the country, was precisely because they were being given a different menu choice than usual, right? You had the Republican nominee making a more communitarian shift, more shifted to the community freedom side of things on the campaign trail than any nominee in, you know, most people's lifetimes. So that changed the result a little bit. But you actually start parsing the data. And for instance, you know, if you took my nations, which I did, my regional cultures, and you just mapped only the rural counties, and you said, and then you mapped just the urban counties. If the Great Divide were urban versus rural, I should be looking at basically a red and pink map and a blue and light blue map, right? It's not at all. Five of the regional cultures on my map, accounting for 51% of the population of the United States, rural and urban counties voted for exactly the same party in all three of the 2012, 2008, 2016, in places like Greater Appalachia and the Deep South and the Far West, urban areas voted Republican in aggregate.
You know, if you so total something all the urban, like yeah. Atlanta, Georgia, or Charlotte, North Carolina is more of an outlier than the norm.
Correct. If you took all the urban, you took all counties and you had the federal government categorize them by urban or rural, some of them voted Democratic. In fact, the density matters and that the very largest ones do vote Democratic. But overall in urban areas, the nations that you would expect to be voting Republican, the urban areas are voting Republican in them and the rural ones. And in several other nations, they're both rural and urban are voting Democratic. And El Norte, the rural El Norte goes, which is the Spanish settled zone in the Spanish borderlands that was originally settled by Spain, you know, their empire moving south to north. They vote Democratic consistently in every election. And in, you know, the greater New England space in Yankeedom, in 2008 voted for Obama. The rural counties voted for Obama by a significant margin. In 2012, it was essentially a tie. And remember in Maine, right? Rural, very homogenous and white, exactly the people that you would imagine, you know, the conventional wisdom would be voting Republican, voted for Obama. 15 of 16 counties, right, went for Obama in both elections. So in most of the counties, rural or urban in New England did as well. So culture and region matters a lot. In fact, it's perhaps the most significant factor of all. And if you go deeper into our history, and I'm historically minded, the regional cultures and sections, as they were sometimes called, have always mattered a great deal more than a rural or urban shift. And that's not to say that rural and urban, I mean, rural and urban is important. Rural regions and urban places have very different interests and do vote differently. And in general, rural ones tend to be more conservative. But to just see things through that lens and be missing the regional effect is a fool's errand for political analysis.
We'll go to Scott, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. So I've read American Nations, and I appreciate its insights. My question for Colin is, how long does he think that this, his sort of filter of how to understand things will continue to be primarily the best one, given, as we get farther away from early settlement patterns, as we have more of a national media culture, as we have settlement and migration patterns of our own time, so, you know, people moving into regions with no connection whatsoever to the original settlers of that area. I'm curious what he thinks, you know, in 100 years, will this still be a powerful tool for predicting how people will vote?
Yeah, great question, Scott. How long will this analysis be the accurate analysis?
Yeah, an excellent question. And in fact, the question one should push back on when hearing about this paradigm. You would think, yeah, in addition to what you said, we have mass merchandising, mass retailing, mass media. People are moving around the continent. We have immigration going on constantly, you know, for the past, you know, 200, 300 years in large quantity from areas that don't include the original dominant settler cultures that set out these regions. You would think, therefore, that everything would be getting more homogenized, that the differences between these regions would be disappearing. But look at the data on almost anything from politics to central values, to attitudes towards gun control or almost any other issue you want, and the divides are growing between them. So how could that be? And there's a few reasons for it, and this comes to answering your question, because it turns out that, say, migration, a lot of social scientists have been looking at internal migration in the country when people move from one place to another. And what they're finding, the bottom line, is that when they analyze who the people are who are moving and their characteristics, say, in politics, why is it that the movement of people, say, from the Northeast down to Florida and the South, the movement of snowbirds, isn't turning the South more blue? Why is that? Well, the answer is that, in general, the people who are leaving and moving somewhere tend to resemble the place they're going politically, not the place they're coming from. In other words, they're voting with their feet, statistically speaking, and actually increasing the difference between the regional cultures. Remember, I said that you have the full spectrum of opinion in every town and every county. Well, those who are, you know, let's say you're, you know, feel like this place I live in, I just love it. Everyone thinks the way I do, and I feel like I really live where I belong. You know, you might be less inclined to try to move and leave, whereas you're like, oh, you know, I can't stand it. All these people around me have all these unexamined assumptions that drive me crazy and so clearly wrong, and nobody even thinks about it. Hey, if my job ever offered me a chance to move, I would go somewhere where people think X, Y, and Z. And, you know, statistically speaking, that's what people are doing. To the extent that they can shape where they're going, they're tending to move into neighborhoods with like-minded people, and we're self-sorting. There's a book about some of this called The Big Sort by Bill Bishop a few years ago that talks about exactly this. So that's one factor. And secondly, briefly on immigration, the whole history of immigration in our country, especially the great defining waves of the late 19th and early 20th century, were not distributed evenly across the continent. In fact, immigrants in general avoided entirely several of the regional cultures. Greater Appalachia, Tidewater, and the Deep South had almost no immigration coming in. It was all concentrated in certain nations, especially New Netherland, the Midlands, and Yankeedom, which only increased the difference in experience and culture and the gaps between them. And to some extent, that exists. And finally, I will say that the argument of the paradigm, you know, the theoretical argument is that people are coming to these regional cultures, and they might bring their own, you know, differences. They come from Mars. They still speak Martian, and they practice Martian food and stuff. But their children will probably know the local language and go to school and such, and that their grandchildren, well, may be vaguely aware of their Martian identity, have assimilated. My argument is that they haven't assimilated into an American culture. They've assimilated over the generations into one of these regional cultures, right down to the dialect of American English they speak. So my answer to your question is, broadly speaking, this could last decades or centuries longer, for sure. Now, cultures change. It just has a lot of inertia. You just don't expect things to happen very fast. So, you know, broadly speaking, I think this will be with us for a long time, because it's been these factors are at play in other cultures elsewhere, and they last a very long time.
And when you name some of the places immigrants have come, your general nations, we're talking about places like New York City, San Francisco, Chicago, Detroit.
To some extent, but even in rural areas, right, get settled, you know, especially in those big past immigration trends, people were actually looking, most people were farmers, and they were looking for somewhere to farm. And the promise that you could actually have your own land in the late 19th century or
sure.
the early 20th century, until fairly recently, they were actually not, I mean, yes, people came to the cities, but they were also going to the countryside. So you had the Scandinavian migration into, you know, the upper parts of Minnesota and upper parts of Midwest and, you know, Germans settling and setting up their own towns and school systems stuff in lots of parts of the Midlands and so on and so forth. So, you know, it wasn't just the cities. It was... It was trying to find land in rural areas, or if you were from a mining culture, you were going to work in the mines in XYZ place in northern Wisconsin or out in the Rockies or what have you.
We'll go to Michael, who's calling from Bass Harbor. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer, and hey, Colin. Thanks for taking my call. I understand that the regional cultures are rooted historically in European settlement. My question would be, how do indigenous populations factor into the cultural landscape in these divergent regions that have been identified by Colin? I'd appreciate any input you have on that. Thanks.
Yes, for sure. I mean, the tragedy writ large of our continent is that, you know, European colonists came and in many regions took the land or, you know, introduced diseases and took the land or took the land and engaged in warfare and seized and, you know, wiped out the civilizations and the people who were here previously, or pushed them aside and set them into a status where they weren't allowed to vote or weren't allowed to participate as citizens, or forced them to, you know, travel hundreds of miles on foot away from where they'd live just to get them out of the way, right? So that's the great tragedy. And what that meant was that those cultures were no longer the dominant cultures. Now, in some regions, the attitude of the settlement culture had was particularly oriented towards engaging with the indigenous people, and therefore in those situations brought on board all sorts of things about the indigenous culture that they encountered and actually incorporated it into their ethos. That, you know, the most benign perhaps is the New France experience, where Samuel Champlain, when he came, the whole idea and approach that France had, very different than New England, was that the Indian tribes they encountered in the St. Lawrence Valley and in New England and in what's now the Canadian Maritimes were potential vassals and allies of the kings of France, and they treated them as such. You know, the Baron Castine, who was the major imperial, you know, officer figure for a long stretch of Maine's history here in this area in the contest between New France and New England, he, you know, married the Penobscot chief's daughter and spent most of his time in the Penobscot's village traveling around with them. His bilingual and bicultural sons went on to have important positions in New France's colonial project in this part of the world. I mean, it was a very different approach, and it incorporated all sorts of things that the book describes about the cultures they encountered. Now, New England and the Puritans' attitude was not any of this, right? Ultimately, the indigenous people that they encountered were identified as being not showing up, to the congregational church on the right day of the week, that maybe they're out there in the wilderness aligned with, you know, the forces of Satan or something else. You know, they were considered dangerous people outside of their society, and therefore things did not go well at all. And so the imprint of those cultures into Yankee society was smaller. But that's the great tragedy, right? And there's other parts. There's one of the nations is First Nation. It only has a small part in the United States, but a huge part of Canada and all of Greenland. And that's a place where indigenous people never lost control of the land and were able to continue, living their lives and continuing their practices in an incredibly dangerous and difficult region, because in the 19th and early 20th century, they were so far removed, so far north, that the European cultures assumed that it wasn't worth going and taking their land. You know, there were never treaties, and there was never an actual expropriation of those lands, which is where you get Nunavut and Greenland, which is almost a freestanding country now of its own, and the considerable autonomy that many of the Canadian First Nations people have now within the Canadian constitutional system over vast areas outside of Nunavut. So, I mean, it's not true of everywhere in the continent. It's just much of our own continent that is tragically how things played out, which is why they're not within the most of the the dominant cultures.
Michael, good question. Thank you for your call. And we are going to take a quick break. But first, a word about tomorrow's program. Join host Cindy Hahn for a conversation about the future of work in the age of artificial intelligence. Is your job at risk? What happens when robots replace humans in the workforce? Email your comments and questions to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. In the meantime, if you have a question for Colin Woodard, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Claremont Hotel, featuring Xanthus Restaurant in Southwest Harbor and online at theclaremonthotel.com. And the Alzheimer's Association's Walk to End Alzheimer's with 7 locations from York Beach to Fort Kent. Details at alz.org/walk.
On the next Speaking in Maine, our final program from our Champlain Institute series.
Genius knows no language, no race, no religion, but it is more likely to flourish where there is freedom and opportunity for all.
Speaking from College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, former Maine Senator George Mitchell addresses the issue of immigration from world history to modern America. That's on the next Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Many of your favorite Maine Public Television programs, both PBS and local, are available online through our video on demand service at mainepublic.org. And if you're in the mood for binge watching or finding something that was broadcast several weeks ago, Evergreen supporters also have access to Passport, which allows extended access to many of the program archives and the ability to watch entire series or seasons, sort of like a public television Netflix service. Passport is already available to supporters of both Maine Public Television and radio supporters who are monthly Evergreen contributors. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, journalist Colin Woodard on how regional differences can explain the nation's political divide. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Shelby calling from Portland. Hi, Shelby.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I think it's kind of funny you said the thing about people moving, because I left a dream job in Texas because I just couldn't stand the political climate. But my kind of general observation is, so many people were not supporters of Trump until he won the primary, and then they were hardcore. I've even seen T-shirts saying, "I'd rather be Russian than a Democrat," which is highly disturbing. So I would love to see a map, or if you think you have an opinion of what a map would look like of people who used to be traditional Republican supporters versus Trump supporters versus Democrats.
Well, that would be an interesting data point. I don't have such a map, and I haven't seen it created. There are vote shift maps. If you Google my name 2016 election, it should take you to a Press Herald article I did that has a whole bunch of maps of what we're talking about here in the 2016 election, including shifts by county, like compared to 2012, how much did they shift blue or red. But in terms of actually dissecting it down to the data collection on Republican voters and how they've changed positions or stances, I don't think anybody's done the kind of polling you would need. The quantity of polling and the richness of the resolution you need to go to a county level, which is what's required to do the American Nations analysis, is very expensive and very time consuming. We don't have a lot of county level polling. And that doesn't matter in a state, states like, Maine or West Virginia and such, where it's all located within one regional culture, but it's critical for understanding Ohio or Pennsylvania or shifts like that. So that's a really interesting question, but I don't think we really have any good data on that, and certainly not the variety I'd need to do an American Nations analysis.
Thank you, Shelby. We're going to go to Nancy, who's calling from Weld, Maine. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. My question, first of all, I want to say that me and a lot of people in my family are big fans of American Nations, and it really has great explanatory power. My question is because I've been really worried about how these regional cultural differences seem to be getting more extreme, and particularly, given the last election, you can see huge regional divides between blue and red, if you just look at the map, as he was talking about earlier. And I'm worried that within a generation, I don't see anything that's going to prevent us having a civil war because the values differences are so great.
Nancy, thank you. Colin, a lot of people worried about this divide and where we're all headed.
Well, I mean, rightly so. I mean, I think the Federation and the Republic are in great danger, and the possibility of things, and as you move forward in years and decades, falling apart, perhaps not peacefully, is absolutely there. I mean, I'm somebody who studied the Balkans and Eastern Europe and covered the aftermath of the Bosnian Civil War. My views of the stability and strength of civilization are perhaps a little less forgiving than many people in that respect. So, yes, one's right to be worried. I would say there's a distinction, though, between the regional divide, that the red-blue divide by county, is actually slightly less, perhaps, in the 2016 election than in past elections, because Trump campaigned by moving more into the communitarian space. You know, I think the key axis is that individualism, common good axis. And Trump was shifted more to the center than previous candidates. So consequently, the map is a little bit less stark than it has been in the past. But that other question of the stability of liberal democracy and the challenge to the republic, that the reason that we're in crisis, and I absolutely think that we are, is because that polarized divide has existed for quite some time and gone unaddressed and festered in the past, you know, two or three decades, that has made the glue which holds our nation, our federation together, has weakened it. And that's really problematic in a nation like ours because, remember, we don't have a common, you know, mystic history going back thousands of years like, other, nation states do. We didn't have a single language that was an American language. We had the language of the empire that we'd abandoned. We don't have historic ties between our nation's presence and a particular piece of landscape that we can think of that hold us together. We don't have a shared ethnography or even religious base. Our, all of our families and don't have a shared past in general. We have a shared future, we hope. But that means that if you start dissolving the solvents constitutionally, institutionally, and in terms of the fundamental values that we're all supposed to ascribe to that hold us together, that places us in a unusually weak position. In fact, we're more fragile in that respect than many of our peer liberal democracies. So we need to fix this at our own. If we don't, it's quite perilous.
Nancy, really good question. We have so many good questions coming in. I'll try to speed up here. A Facebook post from Pat. My family's roots are Franco, Quebec, and the immigration laws were much looser when our family settled in Maine. I have 10 siblings, and several of them are especially harsh on undocumented immigrants, despite our family history. Others of us understand that what was viewed as legal immigration then would be considered illegal today. Yet we all come from the same cultural place. How do you explain this?
That's a terrible irony. Your family's not alone in that being the case. There was very little regulation of immigration in the 19th century, and many people moved and came here in ways that would be considered illegal today, and worked their way up and assimilated and were successful and, became part of, if not the American culture, the Yankee culture, the deep Southern one around them. That just seems to be part of the human experience, right? That, one of the unfortunate aspects of our species is that we, by nature, a lot of us seem to, get ours and close the door behind us. And thinking back on the past and having that historical sense of where our own families came from and the foundations that others and our parents and grandparents built for us is a, extremely valuable exercise everyone should think about, particularly as they look forward as other people are trying to repeat the very pattern that many of us did and our families did.
We'll go to Kathy calling from Freeport. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering what you think about the evangelical Christian movement in terms of, one would think that their values would intersect more with community sort of based voting, and yet they certainly, seem to be more aligned with red
red states.
Yeah, well, that's the funny coalition.
And so what's that about?
That's a really good question. And I mean, that's something I've thought about and read a bunch on. I've spoken actually at a couple pretty big evangelical-ish conferences about American Nations. So, you know, their community is also interested in this sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, both parties have really strange coalitions. That's why I say the individualism, communitarianism thing is a much better way to understand our divides. But the parties have put together unstable coalitions, and the Republican one for some time was a coalition that included libertarians, you know, like Reason Magazine and Cato Foundation, and evangelical Christians who are very much from the communitarian side and in some evangelical communities would like everybody else to share their values and should share their values. Those are two groups that in theory shouldn't be together in the same party. And you have the same odd coalitions on the Democratic side. So yeah, you know, the politics makes for strange alliances. In the end, the evangelicals have ended up with the Republican Party because concerns about key issues have aligned them with the Republicans, and Republicans have reached out on cultural front on things like reproductive rights and the like to form a successful alliances. And in the end, you know, the decision point that many people seem to make about what's most important of the criteria for who they're going to vote for, say, for president, some of those considerations at a higher policy level seem to exceed some of their things about personal behavior and values.
Kathy, thanks for your call. We'll go to Christy calling from Scarborough. Hi, Christy. Go ahead.
Hi. I first want to just mention, following the last caller, that the divisiveness is something certainly to address, that the Maine Council for Social Studies is having its annual conference this October specifically for teachers on teaching in a politically divisive climate. How do you do that? So it's certainly, I think, very aware in the classrooms. My question, though, is your guest was saying that Maine doesn't maybe have such strong regional distinguished areas as other states. I call it it's the Mason-Dixon line between South and North Maine that very much hurts the greater Portland area, that the University of Maine system cuts scholarships to working women, people of color, and brings out-of-state white males mostly to pay sports at Orono. And, of course, most, you know, trustees went to Orono. So, you know, Bangor was the head of the state, of course, 100 years ago when we put the land grant out there. That's just amazing to me how...
Christy, you're starting to cut up, but I think we have actually a couple questions here. People looking at the political and value divide between Maine's two districts. I mean, some people are listening to this, Colin, and saying, what do you mean we're all the same here in Maine? It sure didn't feel like that in 2016 between the first and second congressional district.
Sure. I mean, this is at the highest level, the big dominant cultures at the continent-spanning level. And, you know, here, as in the Balkans and Eastern Europe and anywhere else in the world, at a tighter level of resolution, there's all kinds of enclaves and complexities and subtleties. And you could write an entire book about the conflicts between dominant Yankee culture that came out of Massachusetts and the culture of Maine. In fact, I did. It's called The Lobster Coast. It's about the enormous struggles between Massachusetts and Maine settlers, including a backcountry insurrection, an entire Scots-Irish influence and enclaves and Scots-Irish led struggle against great land barons that shaped our history and helped lead us to having statehood on our own in 1820. You have the effect of the Acadian migration, the Franco-American communities, and that animosity between the coast and the interior and the have-not rim county. So yeah, those are all true, but broadly speaking, those divides are order of magnitudes less than the kind of, top order dominant culture divides that break California and Ohio and Texas. I mean, those are divides that are really, really, really profound, whereas Maine has, you know, a shared history and shared cultural institutions. And if you look back, District 1 and District 2s, you know, tend to vote for the same political candidates in almost all of our elections in the past. You know, we often have, senators and congresspeople in Maine that are from the same parties and the like. So, I think you can overemphasize it. Of course, the differences are there. You know, I grew up in Maine. I grew up actually in have-not Rim County, Maine, and am well aware of the divides we have. But they're a lesser order than what I'm talking about on the continental American nation scale.
Christy, yeah, thank you for your call. Jeff's calling from Aroostook County. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Jennifer. I'm just would have your guest comment on what I believe is a significant issue, and that's income disparity. As your two previous callers mentioned in the book, One Nation Under God, we know that historically speaking, industrialists, the DuPont brothers, for example, found they couldn't use their own words to influence political discourse, but they were able to use religious leaders. And again, also with white trash and 400 years of history and class in American society, it wasn't just Puritans and pilgrims, but there were people who were essentially forced to come here to make profits.
Sure, and Jeff, we're tight on time, so I'm going to call in a chance to respond.
Yeah, so, I mean, yes, income disparities are one of the many pathologies and things which can undermine a liberal democracy. In addition to the books you've mentioned, the sequel to American Nations, American Character, talks about exactly this. The central argument, you know, it's talking about the conflict between individual liberty and the common good and how you balance them, and the fact that a straying too far over to the individual liberty side in recent decades has slowly been destabilizing our liberal democracy, and income disparities and concentrations of power and the lesser ability to have mobility between generations, and all those things are all signs that things are going astray in ways that undermine a liberal democracy. So, yes, I, you know, broadly speaking, you know, I think I agree with the point you're making.
Jeff, thanks so much for your call, and it's a good one. Colin, we have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you a big question. I'm sure it could be a PhD thesis, but I want to ask, are these differences in fringes in our attitudes? Are these differences at the fringes, or is it the center? Is there such a thing as a core American idea that everybody agrees on?
Well, I mean, there are options that we could all decide we were going to agree on. You're not going to get all the regional cultures ever to have consensus, but what's happened in the past is you have a super majority of them that all get in a coalition and agree on enough things to govern. We haven't been in that state in about 35, 40 years, but that's actually the sort of path forward. And the thing, you know, in terms of identity, and that's what I'm working on in my next book, is the forging of the story of who we're supposed to be, right? You had these this in the early republic, you had this split up nation that had just become independent, and there was no answer as to what America was, and there were competing answers to it. And the optimistic answer is that what, regardless of where we all came from and what regional cultures we belong to, that we all shared this shared commitment to creating a liberal democracy, a free society, and furthering the cause of human freedom and equality. That's the Jeffersonian vision in the preamble of the Declaration of Independence. It's what Lincoln reaffirmed in the Gettysburg Address in 1863. There were others who fought very hard against it and said that that's not our identity. And I can't say that that other interpretation has been vanquished.
And we will look forward to that book. Colin Woodard, thanks for being here today. Colin is state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. He has written a number of books, including American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. We've published his most recent opinion piece in the New York Times on our Maine Calling Facebook page and website. John Keimel ran the board today. Our volunteer Rick Austin answered the calls. The show is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.